Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to have a guest we've had many times before, but not for a couple years now. Previously, he was a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from the state of Vermont. Today, he is Vermont's junior senator. Our guest will be Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont, for the full hour here on Media Matters. Should be a terrific show. Before we go to Senator Sanders, who will be joining us from his phone in Vermont, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The House held a hearing last week about privacy and the Internet. Under particular scrutiny was a technology called deep packet inspection that is used by internet service providers to manage broadband data traffic and target advertising to individual internet users. With deep packet inspection, an ISP can see everything a user sends or receives and every site they visit on the web. Representative Edward Markey of Massachusetts expressed his concern about the sensitivity of personal information being collected.
Consumers deserve clear, conspicuous and constructive notice about what broadband providers' use of deep packet inspection will be. Meaningful opt-in consent for such use, and no monitoring or data interception of those consumers who do not grant consent for such use.
In an interchange with Robert Dykes, CEO of behavioral advertising company Nebuad, Markey pressed the issue of the need for consumers to opt in to targeted advertising. Nebuad currently gathers and sells information about users unless they opt out.
It's just like saying that the mailman can open up any letter, can open up any package, find out what's in it, and then start to partner with other companies, letting them know what individual Americans are receiving in the mail, what kind of packages are coming to their house. But it's okay because the consumer doesn't know that you're doing it and hasn't given you the opportunity to say to the mailman, stop opening my packages, stop opening my mail. I don't want anyone to know about it. And so we've got a real problem here.
Markey indicated that Congress could take action to strengthen privacy protections.
The very principles of individual freedom, individual liberty, your right not to have either the government or a private sector company coming into your life without your permission is central to who we are as Americans. That's what we fought for. That's what we continue to fight for.
The conventional wisdom among local television news broadcasters is that quality journalism doesn't attract good ratings. If it bleeds, it leads has been the mantra of the TV news industry for years, spawning sensationalized stories of crime and disasters that is now daily fare on most local news broadcasts. But a new study disproves the notion that audiences prefer superficial tabloid coverage to well-written quality journalism. Professor Marion Just of Wellesley College and the Joan Shorenstein Center on Press Politics and Public Policy at Harvard says she and her co-author Todd Belt initially wanted to give a nudge to the industry. The researchers compiled a huge amount of data from nearly 34,000 news stories from 50 TV markets across the country. The stories were then scored for quality, with criteria determined by news professionals.
We began to look at all of this data and said, you know, let's see if we can figure out how this matches up with the ratings. And what we found was that better stories tended to get better ratings. And by better, we didn't mean necessarily that they were only on politics or esoteric subjects, but stories that people in the journalism business told us were better stories. That is, stories that had good sourcing, multiple points of view, a balance of views, experts, use of data.
So why do so many local news networks continue with superficial stories? Just says that local TV news is a victim of its own success.
Because it has attracted such a large audience, the local stations use it as a cash cow. And in order to make the maximum profit, they've been squeezing the actual budgets, which forces news directors to cheapen the stories. And how do you do that? You put fewer personnel on the story. You accept a video news release. You don't get the other side of the story. Those are things that make the news cheaper to produce, but it also loses audience.
Professor Just and Professor Belt have written a book published by Cambridge University Press called We Interrupt This Newscast, How to Improve Local News and Win Ratings, Too. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live this lovely Sunday, July 27th, 2008. As I said at the top of the hour, we have a show that's been much anticipated here at WILL for quite some time, and I'm delighted to welcome as our guest today the senator from the state of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, who is going to be joining us shortly. Bernie, are you there?
I am right here, Bob.
Well, very shortly, in fact. Thank you so much for joining us today, Senator.
My pleasure.
You know, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but right at the top, I want to let our listeners who might not be familiar with this know that one of the reasons you are our guest today on this program, Media Matters, is that you have been, since you first got to Washington in 1991, I believe, in the House of Representatives, have been concerned with issues of media, journalism, having a viable press system for democracy. And we're going to talk about that in this hour, and listeners should certainly call in and ask about those issues. But at the same time, there is so much happening politically that I think our listeners, and I certainly would like to get your take on, that I think I'm going to run a broader gamut of issues for us today.
Okay, well, certainly, Bob, I have been interested in media for a very long time, and I really want to congratulate you and your colleagues at Media Matters for touching on an issue which not enough people are involved in. Because if you're concerned about war, if you're concerned about poverty, if you're concerned about the disintegration of our health care or the collapse of the middle class, you must be concerned about media in America and the fact that fewer and fewer large media conglomerates control what we see, hear, and read. And you guys have done a fantastic job in engaging people in that discussion, and I look forward to working with you in the years to come.
Well, yeah, we certainly will, Senator Sanders. You know, the first thing I want to talk about is the top news story that's been breaking, or one of the top news stories, there are several, but in the last week, which is the idea, which is what's going on in Iraq, in the Iraq War. You've opposed the Iraq War from the very beginning. You've been one of the strongest critics of the invasion of Iraq. Now, what is your sense of where this matter stand with Iraq and what's going to happen there?
Well, I think the very good news is that Iraqi President Maliki basically endorsed the Obama plan for troop withdrawal. And it put both John McCain and President Bush very much on the defensive, because what they have been saying for the longest time is that we're going to stay there as long as we want to stay there, until we determine when it is appropriate to leave. And what Maliki said is, wait a second, this is our country. We want a timeline. We want you out of there. And that is very significant, and I think has put both Bush and McCain on the defensive. Second of all, I think what the American people are catching on to is that with our economy doing very, very poorly, with us having a national debt right now of over $9.5 trillion, with so many unmet needs facing our country, whether it's health care, whether it's the infrastructure, whether it is the need to transform our energy system to sustainable energy, whatever it may be, that it is absurd that we continue to spend over $10 billion every single month on the war in Iraq. not to mention losing our focus in terms of the very serious military problems we face in Afghanistan. So bottom line is that I think we have got to end this war in Iraq as quickly as possible. The Iraqi people can and must, with their government, take control over the situation, and we've got to start focusing on the needs of the American people.
You know, Senator Sanders, one thing that confused me about Senator McCain's position is that on one hand he's saying the surge has been a success, we've basically won the Civil War. On the other hand, he says that, but we can't bring the troops home.
Right. Well, that's a real contradiction. And I would say again that McCain's position looks very strange when we have been touting the fact that we have created a democracy in Iraq, and now the Iraqi government that we put into place wants to do something, and you're having Bush and McCain in opposition to what this government wants to do.
I think Senator McCain's line is, you know, once he's in, he'll be able to use whatever pressure is to convince Maliki and the Iraqis to change their mind.
Yeah, but on the surface, that looks totally absurd, and that really speaks to the word occupation. Occupation. We will convince them, but it happens to be their country. So we're delighted to see that the situation is stabilizing in Iraq. Unfortunately, that is not the case in Afghanistan. We are now losing more troops in Afghanistan than in Iraq. Afghanistan, of course, was the country that was harboring Osama bin Laden in the very first place. So I think we're going to see some fundamental changes in our relationship to Iraq in the very near future.
Senator Obama is calling for a significant increase of U.S. troops to Afghanistan. And, in fact, in his trip to Europe, in his speech in Berlin, he implored the Europeans to contribute to the troops in that cause. What is your take on the Afghan war? Do you think that's the smart course, that we should increase troop levels?
I think we may have to put more troops in there. I think we are losing ground in Afghanistan. I think originally there was a great deal of support for our effort. Unfortunately, we're not getting international support. The last thing in the world I think you want to see is the Taliban regaining influence in increasing parts of that country.
The question I have about that is, do you think that a military victory is going to be possible in the traditional military sense in a country like Afghanistan?
No, I think clearly one of the reasons that we're running into problems, and one of the reasons that the Taliban has been successful in resurfacing is the failure of economic reconstruction. So I think hand in hand with the military presence, we're going to have to show the people in Afghanistan that we can help rebuild their economy and their schools and their healthcare system.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to have with me today on the line U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders from the great state of Vermont, taking time from his extremely busy schedule to join us on this Sunday afternoon. Right now, our phone system is such that I'm not going to be taking calls. I'm going to hog you the entire hour, Senator Sanders, and have you to myself, much to the dismay of my listeners. But please sit back, relax, and enjoy this program. Bernie, you know, one of the things that's striking is you got elected to the Senate in 2006 in a year that, for the Democratic Party, you're not a Democrat, but you caucus with the Democrats, for a year in which the Democrats won a dramatic victory in both the House and the Senate. All signs point this year to another series of large gains for the Democrats, certainly in the Senate side, if not the House side. And the immediate future for the Republican Party looks extraordinarily grim. What do you think accounts for this? What do you think puts us in the political moment we're in? And what do you think this means? What's going on?
Well, let me answer your question in several ways. I think you're factually correct. I mean, all of the pundits are telling us is Democrats are going to pick up more seats in the House. They're going to surely pick up more seats in the Senate. Republicans acknowledge that. How many, we don't know, but it could be anywhere from 3 to 7 to 8. But the first point that I want to make on that regard, Bob, is that while the Democrats will pick up more seats, that should not for one second indicate to political activists or people who are concerned about the future of this country that we simply not continue to be deeply involved in the political process. It's one thing to have a whole lot of Democrats, but not a lot of these guys are necessarily going to be progressive Democrats. And what we need to formulate is a progressive agenda on foreign policy, on the economy, on health care, on the environment, on global warming, on civil liberties, on the media. And just because you have more Democrats there doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to see this country moving in a progressive direction. Second of all, as to why this is happening, I think the answer is fairly obvious. And that is, you have a country where the average American understands that in almost every area that you can think of, we are moving in the wrong direction. We have a president today who will certainly go down in history as the worst president in the modern history of America, and maybe in our entire history. And if you're the average person and you're looking at the economy, what do you see? You see that your standard of living has gone down. You're seeing that everything being equal, unless we change policies, your kid will have a lower standard of living than you do. You're seeing the gap between the very rich and everybody else growing wider. You're seeing more and more people fall into poverty. You're seeing, since Bush has been president, some 8 million people lose their health insurance, 3 million people lose their pensions, and the United States ending up with a distribution of wealth and income which is more unfair than any other major country on earth. So I think it's very hard, if you're an ordinary person, not to see the disastrous impact that Bush's policies have had on this country and the need to move in a new direction. Now, the really interesting question out there is not just that the Democrats are poised to gain in the House and the Senate, but why, given that reality, Obama is not 20 points ahead of John McCain, and why some people still think that McCain has a chance to win this election. The reality is that any objective assessment of McCain's views and policies would lead you to conclude that in most areas he is following Bush's footsteps, and in some areas, say in terms of tax breaks for the rich, he is even worse. And the fact that he is still a viable candidate, still could win this election, is very disturbing and tells me that we have got to just do everything that we can at the grassroots level to make sure that doesn't happen.
Bernie Sanders, you've been in the Senate for 2 years. Both Obama and McCain are among your 99 colleagues that join you in the U.S. Senate. You've gotten to know them to some extent, and their staff. I assume your staff has as well over the course of the past 2 years. What have you learned about each of these two men from your time in the Senate, or earlier in the case of McCain, from your time in the House?
Well, honestly, I don't know John McCain all that well. I knew him just a very little bit when I was in the House. And since I've been in the Senate, he has not been on the floor of the Senate very often. He doesn't vote very often, and he's been campaigning almost all of the time. Obama sits, I think, literally next to me on the Veterans Committee and on the Health Education Committee, Kennedy's Committee. So I've gotten to know him fairly well. And I think what we can say about Obama is you got a guy who is very, very, very smart. He's a very, very bright guy, clearly an inspiring figure. He was kind enough to come to Vermont for my campaign, and we rented the largest facility in Burlington, Vermont, and he ended up bringing out two or three times as many people as we could accommodate. We had thousands of people out on the street. So this guy has a charisma about him, and I don't use that word too often, but he clearly is a charismatic figure. Now, I think from a political point of view, the right wing is saying, well, this guy is the most liberal member of the United States Senate. Well, for better or for worse, he's not. He really is not. His politics, I think, on the issues are not significantly different, for better or for worse, than Hillary Clinton's, for example. But he is extremely smart. He does understand what's going on in the world. And I think there is right now a lot of pressure on him from corporate interests, from the conservative wing of the Democratic Party. And for those of us who are progressives, it is very, very important for him to know that there will be strong support for him if he moves in a progressive direction. And that is what I see the task of the moment is right now in terms of the campaign, and certainly the day after he gets elected, if he does get elected.
Say you're sitting next to Senator Obama at some point in the next couple months or right around election time, and then he says to you, Senator Sanders, in your mind, what would be the three or four areas I should move in dramatically to really announced to the American people this is an administration serious about fundamental change. What do you think the areas are that are sitting there that are ripe for action and that there are actions out there? We've got good ideas. We just need to implement.
Well, first of all, I think it's important that he explain to the American people that he understands the reality facing the collapsing middle class and that he, on a moral basis, is disturbed that the very wealthiest people in this country not only have such a large percentage of the wealth, but have so much power. He has got to make that clear to the American people that America is not about a nation in which the top one-tenth of 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%. I think banging away at that theme, that we can be a more just society, that all of our people can enjoy a good standard of living, is terribly, terribly important. Number two, there are just many immediate things that have to be done. Global warming is a huge problem, not just for this country, obviously, but for the entire planet. Obama was one of those people who came on board legislation that I offered quite soon after I became a senator, which was the strongest global warming legislation introduced in the Senate, would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050. I think he has got to get out there and say we have a planetary crisis. That's the bad news. The good news is, and he understands this, and he has talked about this, is that if we move toward energy efficiency, if we move toward wind and solar and geothermal and biomass, not only can we reverse global warming, but we can create millions of good jobs. So stimulating the economy by transforming our energy system would be an extraordinary step forward for this country. Number two, I think in terms of health care, the United States today remains the only nation in the industrialized world that does not have a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people. Obama must make it clear that health care should be a right of all people and that we can, in fact, cover all of our people without spending any more than we're currently spending, which is twice as much per capita than any other country on earth. I think that's terribly important. We are working, hopefully with his office, we're working right now, and I hope I get him on board, legislation that can be moved very, very quickly in terms of primary health care. Bob, we have 56 million Americans today who have no access to a doctor. By simply expanding the community health center program, which works very well in terms of health, dental, low-cost prescription drugs, mental health counseling, you can provide primary health care to every man, woman, and child in this country in a few years, which would pay for itself by people keeping people out of emergency rooms and hospitals. So those are some of the immediate things that I think could really touch a nerve in this country. But basically to say to the American people, government can work, we can create good-paying jobs, we can create more equality in this country, we could deal with the major global environmental problems, global warming problems that we have. I think that could transform and excite the American people that they are part of a democracy, not rather just bystanders watching what the rich and the powerful do.
Senator Sanders, you mentioned the health care plan, that that this is the place to go to work on. Of course, Senator Obama's health care plan that he announced with much fanfare early in his presidential campaign has come under considerable criticism from John Edwards, from Hillary Clinton, of course, and also from people like Paul Krugman, the columnist and economist at the New York Times. Do you think if he's elected, he'll be open to scrapping that plan and working to come up with something a little better?
Bob, the answer, as I mentioned earlier, the good news is, and I say this as somebody who knows him, he's a very smart guy. And he's not just the smart guy, he has a sense. He does know. If you ask Barack Obama, you talk to him about a single-payer system, he knows what a single-payer system is, for example, which I support. So I think the key here is to rally the American people. And if there's one message that I want to get across to your listeners today, please do not think that we have done our job simply by electing Barack Obama. There is tremendous pressure on him. Right now, the Democratic Party is receiving more money from the business community than the Republican Party, because the business community smells who the winners are. And there's going to be tremendous pressure on it from the conservative wing, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And I think if we can rally grassroots support that says, we will be with you if you are prepared to take on the insurance companies, or ripping off the American people right and left. The drug companies who are charging us the highest prices in the world. We know that they're going to be 30-second ads attacking you. We know the power of these people who have hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on lobbyists and campaign contributions. But we will support you. We will be there. We're going to fight for progressive change. So I think that's the issue. Obama, I think, has the potential to come to the White House in the same way that Roosevelt did, maybe in 1932. And you remember, Roosevelt was not the most progressive governor of the state of New York, nor is Obama the most progressive member of the United States Senate. But Roosevelt was smart enough to look at what was going on in this country in the midst of a horrendous depression, 25-30% unemployment, and he was prepared to take bold action. And I think that's the dynamic that is taking place now with Obama in this coming year.
Our guest, Senator Bernie Sanders from the great state of Vermont. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois, this Sunday, July 27th, a wonderful summer day here in the heartland. What's the weather like back in Vermont,
Bernie? It is beautiful. Beautiful. Just a beautiful day.
And again, thank you so much, Senator Sanders, for taking time from your schedule to join us today. Unfortunately, the phone lines are not operative for today's program. I get to do all the talking, which is a great pleasure for me. Bernie, you know, you've talked about the economy, the collapsing middle class, which you have been, I think, really one of the leading figures, if not the leading figures, on Capitol Hill for years now, and making the case about how crucial it is to battle economic and social inequality.
You know, Bob, let me just say something and tie it into the media issue.
Okay.
You know, I know you have been in the forefront of media reform in America, and I think many of your listeners will know that the media collapsed, the American media collapsed around the war in Iraq and supporting Bush's effort to get us into that war. But the other area where there has been a collapse in the last 10 years is just on the economy. The fact that both Congress and the media have allowed this president, until very recently, with the foreclosure crisis and now the high energy costs, but just, you know, a year ago, 6 months ago, read what Bush was saying. The economy is robust. The economy is strong. We're seeing economic growth. And while he is saying that, and while the media is reporting that, the middle class has been collapsing. People working longer hours for low wages. So the point that I try to make for so many years now is say it wasn't true. It wasn't true. The economy is not doing well. Yeah, if you're rich, it is doing well, but not if you're in the middle class. And this ties, again, right into the failure of the media to talk about the reality facing ordinary people.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, Bernie, or interesting you should mention that, because during the presidential debates, there was very little discussion of the economy in any substantive manner, at least in the Democratic debates that I saw, and probably in the Republican, for that matter, that went beyond a sort of sloganeering. But one of the testier exchanges came, and I can't recall who the host was, one of the TV moderators, a millionaire journalist, who when talking about tax policy framed it all about taxes on the really wealthy people and how concerned he was that that would hurt people. Do you recall that episode?
I do. I think it was Gibson, was it, or ABC?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, that's how absurd it is. 5 million Americans have slipped into poverty since Bush has been president. How much discussion do you hear that? Edwards was strong on that issue, but other than him, not a whole lot of discussion. The fact right now that we have millions of people who really don't have enough income to adequately feed their families. But most importantly, when we talk about media, what you're talking about, as you well know, Bob, is how the issues are framed. Who determines tomorrow what's going to be on the front pages of the Washington Post, the New York Times, or the lead story on CBS? That's what the issue is. And as a nation, has somebody put out there that there is something fundamentally wrong in America, that the wealthiest 0.1% of income earners earn more than the bottom 50%? Is that a persistent theme in the media? You virtually never hear about it. Or that for the first time in the modern history of this country, we are seeing a situation where our kids may have a lower standard of living than we are, despite a significant increase in worker productivity and certainly an increase in technology. What does this say about the whole theory of unfettered free trade that was supposed to improve our standard of living? What does it say about deregulation and the effort to destroy trade unionism in America and weaken our unions? Well, we don't put those things into a context. And I think the result of that is the American people are baffled. Why are they working longer hours for lower wages? How many people even know if you watch TV, that we are the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't have a national health care program. What we know is government health care is terrible. It's awful. Yeah, well, that's why every other major country in the world has a national health care program, except us. So, you know, when we talk about all of these important issues, we also always have to keep our eye on media because people get their information from the TV, primarily from radio. And that is, again, why the work that you are doing in trying to democratize media, force other points of view into discussion, is so terribly important.
Well, Senator Sanders, when I did ask you about the areas you'd suggest or recommend that President Obama and the new Congress attend to, you mentioned health care, you mentioned going directly at global warming and climate change, the environment. You've talked a lot about the economy. Are there specific measures that you think an Obama administration working with the Senate and the House could pass that could have dramatic effect on these issues?
Well, for example, we have, under George Bush, provided hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%. At the very least, and I would go further than that, those tax breaks have got to be rescinded. And what you can do with that money is not only use some of it for deficit reduction, but you could use a lot of that to rebuild our infrastructure. If we are serious, for example, about moving towards sustainable energy, and by that I mean wind, not only photovoltaics, but solar thermal plants in the Southwest, we're going to need to rebuild our energy grid. And that's an expensive proposition. If you drive the streets and the roads of the state of Vermont, and I think in most communities all over America, we need to rebuild our roads, our bridges. We need a new rail system. All of that costs money. And I would rather spend money on that than give tax breaks to billionaires. And then there's another area that does not get enough discussion, certainly not from the Republicans, of course, or Bush, but not even from the Democrats. Bob, when we talk about spending, we are spending not just some $10 billion a month in Iraq. We are also going to be passing a military budget, defense budget, of something like $515 billion. That is a huge sum of money. Do we need to spend $515 billion? Or is a lot of that money being used to bolster up a Cold War weapon systems? Is there a lot of waste and duplication within the military? The answer is absolutely there is. So the real challenge that Obama has, understanding that we have $9.5 trillion national debt, is to cut spending in those areas where we can and invest in those areas where we need to invest. And that is something, certainly, that I hope a larger Democratic majority in the House and Senate will make it easier for him to do.
Our guest, Bernie Sanders, the United States Senator from Vermont, joining us today live from Vermont. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I've been informed that we have our phone lines working now, so we can take a couple calls. Please call at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And we already have a caller who's been patiently waiting for God knows how long. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's a great pleasure talking to you. Could you possibly explain how we can have a democracy in this country with having not a third party on the left? I mean, it's almost unthinkable. And is Ralph Nader right that we're either on the road to or have become a neo-corporate fascist state? And I'll let you go with the question, and thank you for taking it.
Well, let me just say this, and I say this as the only independent, the only member of the Senate, I guess, in the history of this country who was elected as an independent, who has never been elected as a Democrat or Republican. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington and won that election in 1981, I defeated a Democrat. So I've defeated Democrats and I've defeated Republicans. And I think that obviously in a free-flowing democracy, you're going to have a lot more than just two major parties. And a third, fourth party is just fine by me. But let me also say this. I think the immediate crisis that we have right now is to see that right-wing extremism is defeated. I think, you know, when Nader ran in 2000 and 2004, he talked about building this third party. Well, it hasn't happened. It has not happened. I think everybody knows that it has not happened. So So if in areas around the country, and I got to tell you, in the state of Vermont, I think we probably have the most successful progressive third party. There are six progressives in the Vermont legislature, House of Representatives. But right now, my focus is on defeating McCain, and I will be very, very strongly supporting Obama.
Senator Sanders, going back again to the whole give advice to the Obama administration from Senator Sanders meme, which I've been working, turning to foreign policy, obviously ending the war in Iraq is job one that he has to do to sort of free his administration, ending it successfully. What other big moves globally do you think a progressive policy would be for the United States in the next administration?
I think, by the way, Bob, I mean, I think it's a very good omen. The tremendous support that Obama demonstrated abroad in his recent trip is very exciting, I think, for many of us in the United States. You know, when Bush goes abroad, you know, most of the people who are out to greet him are demonstrators against American policy. So I think by simply, for a start, reaching out to the international community in the United Nations and saying, look, we understand that if we are going to be effective in fighting international terrorism, which is a serious issue, not just for the U.S., but for the entire world, we've got to work together on that. And we understand that the solution is not just going to be military, that we're going to have to show the poor people in the Muslim world and all over this world that we understand what they're going through and we are going to work with them. We understand that we are not going to solve global warming just by one country doing the right thing. All of us are going to have to do the right thing. And clearly, in terms of that particular area, the Bush administration has literally been beyond comprehension, going so far as to forbid members of the administration want to tell the truth about global warming, even making that public to the American people and being, you know, incredibly anti-science. So I think doing away with the Bush unilateralism, which has existed for the last 7.5 years, is a major step forward. Working with the international community to address the issues of poverty, terrorism, global warming would be a great start in the right direction.
Our guest, Senator Bernie Sanders. The phone lines are now lighting up, Senator. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air.
Okay. Is that me? Or?
It is you.
Okay. It's an honor to speak to you, Senator. I have three questions. One, what effect do you think the voter ID laws, which could impinge on a wide range, range of voters, which the Supreme Court cleared the way for, and also the computerized voting situation. Also, are you familiar with Vincent Bugliosi's new book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, which has received very low coverage by the media? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you, sir.
Okay, I think the voter ID issue is a big deal. It is no great secret that the Republican Party, in general, wants to keep voter turnout as low as possible because they understand that the rich and the upper middle class not only vote, they will contribute heavily to Republican candidates. And if you can keep poor people and minority people and young people from voting, the Republicans see this as a real winner. So any kind of hurdle you can put up by telling, for example, some senior citizen, low-income senior citizen who may not own a car, may not have a quote-unquote government ID, that you're going to need that and confuse people and worry people, from their point of view, that's a good idea. Obviously, I believe very much the opposite. So I think this voter ID business, ostensibly being brought forth to combat voter fraud, when to the best of my knowledge, there is very little voter fraud in this country, and it should be addressed very seriously. That's a serious crime. But under the guise of dealing with voter fraud, they are clearly trying to discourage low-income people, moderate-income people, seniors from voting. So we have got to be as vigorous in every way that we can to combat that. I think what you will probably see in this campaign is the Obama people, because they have the resources, among other things, and they have enough lawyers out there, to make sure that what happened in 2000, some degree in 2004, does not happen again. But in general, I will do my best, and I hope some of my colleagues will join me in striking down these voter ID laws. They are, it's the old poll tax. Once again, it is discriminatory against the poor people.
And then he asked about the computerized voting. What's your take on that?
You mean the computer? I have concerns about that. I think you're seeing even some conservative secretaries of state making the point that so long as there's any doubt that these touchscreen computers can be hijacked, can be tampered with, we should be more conservative. So I don't have a problem with paper ballots. In Vermont, we have machines that are not going to be tampered with, and I would just as soon be conservative and wait another hour for voting results than run the risk that somebody could get into these machines.
And then finally, the caller did ask about Vincent Bugliosi, who's written a new book calling for the indictment, I think, of George Bush for murder. And he spoke just last week before the committee of Congressman Conyers on the not really impeachment hearings, but rather sort of something close to that, but not that that was held in Washington. When you were on the show a couple of years ago, you showed little interest, as I recall, that time in pursuing impeachment. As
look, here is the point. I mean, okay. And I understand where people are coming from and where the caller is coming from. As I said earlier on the show, I think Bush certainly is the worst president in the modern history of our country. He misled us in the war in Iraq. He's savage attacks on civil liberties and so forth and so on. And I think we could deal with those things. But I think if you go to the ordinary American today and you say to them, hey, how are things going? Don't you think really we've got to try George W. Bush on murder trial? They'll look at you like you're crazy. And they'll say, you know what? I can't afford $4.10 per gallon of gas. My kid doesn't have health insurance. My job just went to China. So I think, you know, from where I sit, I think we've got to focus on those issues now, which mean the most to ordinary Americans, and not give. I mean, the Republican Party would not mind at all having an impeachment hearing. They would see it as a huge advantage to them, because then they put on 30-second ads and saying, well, you're paying, you can't afford your home heating oil, Democrats are impeaching George Bush. What do you think? And it would work for them. So my focus right now is on the election that is coming forward, and I hope that people will focus on developing the strongest grassroots movement this country has ever seen.
Before we go back to the phone line, Senator Sanders, I did want to ask you real quickly. You've been in the U.S. House of Representatives for 8 terms, I believe it was,
yes.
And now you're in your first term in the Senate. From your perspective, as a public servant, is there a big difference being a member of the House and being a member of the Senate? And if there is,
what is a huge difference? You know, obviously, you know, there are 100 members of the Senate and 435 in the House. I'm on 5 committees in the Senate, and I was on 2 very, very large committees in the House. I'm part of the majority now, as part of the minority there. I mean, so you can do things in the Senate as an average senator that you cannot do in the House of Representatives. No question about that. The frustration that exists right now, not just for me, but for, I think, the American people and for members of the Senate, is the Republicans have now brought forth over 80 filibusters. Just yesterday, Bob, I attempted to get a bill passed that would double the amount of money that goes to the low-income home energy assistance program. That makes sure that people in the northern part of our country don't freeze to death or go cold in the winter, and people in the southern part of this country who are old and frail don't die of heat exhaustion when the temperature gets to 110. And we were filibustered again by the Republicans. We won 50-35, but I didn't get the 60 votes that I needed. So there's that element of frustration with the current political dynamic in the Senate. On the other hand, you know, we have been able to, as a member of the Energy Committee, just get provisions in the energy bill that I never in a million years could have done in the House. I was active on veterans issues. I'm on the Veterans Committee, and we're doing a whole lot for veterans, including a new education bill, et cetera, et cetera. So the bottom line is that obviously in the Senate you can do a lot more than you can in the House.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580 from Urbana, Illinois. I'm Bob McChesney. Our guest today, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Let's go to line 3. Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello. I wonder if you'd comment some more on election reform. In particular, I was wondering about the role of instant runoff voting. Recently, one of our local political leaders told us that it had been a failure in California and Minnesota, and that it endangered the political gains made by our black citizens over the last 50 years.
Well,
thank you, caller.
Okay. we need election reform. And by election reform, I certainly include in there campaign finance reform. After all is said and done, the wealthy in this country and people who work for large corporations have a tremendous influence over the political process by the money they control and the amount of money they spend in campaign contributions and advertising and lobbying and so forth and so on. I believe in public funding of elections. I think we're seeing in some states, the state of Maine, for example, where, as I understand it, most people now run for the legislature. They're Democrats and Republicans and others, Green, because there's a strong Green Party in Maine, run with public funding. And I think that is the right thing to do. In terms of election reform, we briefly talked about concerns about touchscreen computers. And until that technology is far more advanced, I would junk those and move back to more conservative ways to make sure that everybody's vote counts. I would do everything that I can in terms of election reform to make it easier for people to vote. You know, in countries like Canada, almost by definition, when you reach 18, you are registered to vote. In this country, depending on the state that you are in, it is more or less difficult to register to vote, and I think we want to change that. Certainly, I believe in same-day registration. Minnesota, a number of other states have that. Sometimes a lot of people get involved in and interested in a campaign the day before the election. They walk in there and the clerk says, sorry, you have to register, you know, a month ago, 2 weeks ago, and I would change that as well. So there is a lot to be done to make our election system more democratic and fairer.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line two. Urbana, you're on the air with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders.
Two questions. We have not been able to win the war on drugs here. How can we expect to win the war on drugs thousands of miles away in Afghanistan? That's one. Second question is, would it be viable to purchase the opium supply that they grow? We would, in fact, take tens of millions of dollars away from the Taliban, and we would save tens of millions of dollars because we wouldn't need as much military from a weakened Taliban. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller.
The caller makes, the second point that the caller makes is a very important point. The Taliban is getting a lot of their financing by growing opium. And to the degree that we can cut that source of funding, that would be a huge step forward. And there are some suggestions out there from simply bribing these farmers, giving these farmers the money they need to survive without growing opium. And, you know, I think that in general makes sense.
Bernie, related to his first question on the war on drugs, let me take that in a slightly different direction. The United States currently has a prison population and a population of largely men, but not exclusively men, who are part of the prison complex in the sense of either being on parole or in prison itself or somehow connected to the criminal justice system, that's astronomical by any standard. We account for a huge proportion of the world's prisoners today. And, you know, this is an issue that almost gets no attention, I think largely because these are people who are from the poorest sectors of our society, oftentimes people of color. Is this a federal issue or is this just the way it works in America?
No, I mean, it's a federal issue, it's a state issue, it's a local issue. As you know, Bob, we have more people behind bars than any country in the world. I mean, people would think, well, China is a communist, authoritarian country, it's a country many times larger than the United States, surely they're going to have more people in jail than we do. And the answer is no, we do. We have more people in jail. And often we spend $50,000 per person to keep that person in jail. So I think that we need to radically rethink the issue, especially of keeping nonviolent people in jail at great expense. And I think that there are ways that we can address that issue. Save lives. I mean, when people go to jail for a number of years, more often than not, whatever problems they may have had, they got them in there in the first place, they're going to be worse by the time they get out. And you're going to see a lot of people returning to jail. So I think there's a lot that can be done about that issue.
Before we go to our next caller, Bernie, as a point I just wanted to make, that some of our listeners might not be familiar with your own history as a political activist. You ran for office in Vermont in various races numerous times before you won anything. And if I'm not mistaken, your first one or two times out of the gate, you were really down there at the 1, 2, 3% level. But you stuck with it. What did you learn that you think is important that other people around the country ought to learn about electoral politics from your experiences?
Well, I ran in the early 1970s as part of a third party in the state of Rome. It's called the Liberty Union Party, and got 2% the first time I ran, 1% the second, 4% the third, 6% the fourth, and I kind of stopped running. And then I ended up a few years later becoming the mayor of the city of Burlington, the largest city in the state, as an independent, won that by 10 votes. I think the answer is that sometimes you just, you know, what happens today is that to run for office, people just raise a huge sum of money and so forth, and they do radio and TV ads. We did it very much the old-fashioned way. We did it through a grassroots effort and got my ideas out there, got my, you know, beliefs out there, and then was fortunate enough to win as mayor. And generally speaking, people thought I did a good job and was reelected three times after that, defeating Democrats and Republicans, defeating a candidate who had the support of the Democrat and Republicans combined. So, I think hard work and door-to-door efforts and just trying to get out and explain yourself to people is perhaps the most important thing that one can do.
Let's go back to the phone lines, try to get a couple more calls in before the program ends. Line 4, Edgar County, you're on the air with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders. How would we deal with water, a hot third rail issue, population control, and a quote of Ronald Reagan in 1964 that those who would deal with our freedom for security have embarked on a totalitarian downward course? I'd appreciate your comment.
Okay, Bernie?
Well, water is a huge issue. Water is an issue that we do not discuss enough, not only in the United States, but throughout the entire world. There are some people who believe that the major military struggles that are going to take place around the world in the future is precisely going to be over water. And clearly, with global warming resulting in more drought, it is an ever-increasing problem. So I think that for a start, if we're serious about dealing with the water crisis, we've got to deal with global warming in a very dramatic way. I think we also have to take a hard look at how we utilize water in this country today. In some ways, it is in very, very wasteful form. So I certainly agree with this caller that water is a major issue.
We've only got a couple minutes left. I want to get one more caller in who's been waiting patiently. So let's now go to line 2. Urbana, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Hello. I had a question about, it kind of goes back to the drug discussion earlier. And the question was, it was basically the war on drugs terminology. It seems like if you've read or heard George Lakoff speak about this, it seems like taking an old terminology frame to support a conservative view, and maybe that's part of the not making headway. You know, I've heard him describe Obama's politics of compassion as like a good framing of how to get out progressive ideas. And I wonder if you're aware of like an overall effort to look at all of the terminology and deal with it appropriately.
Well, yeah, I am familiar with Lakoff, and I think there is a strong understanding that the Republicans have done a lot better than progressive people in terms of soundbite terminology, and that we can learn something about that. On the other hand, sometimes these issues go beyond sound bites, and they have a lot to do with where you're coming from. And I think as a nation, and you know, and I picked this up just in the last hour on this show, the major issue facing this country that we people really are at now, well, we've got to understand that, is not drug policy. I have real concerns about the war on drugs. But the real issue, it's not even election reform. People have got to understand that there are millions and millions of Americans today who thought they were in the middle class, who thought that their kids were going to do okay, who are now looking around saying it ain't happening. They are struggling. Let me be very clear. There are people right now who are worried about how they're not going to freeze to death this winter, how they're going to make a living, how they're going to send their kids to college, how they're going to provide health care. So I think, you know, the caller is absolutely right. I think the right has done a lot better than the left in terms of framing issues and sound bites. But on the other hand, what the left has got to understand is that the middle class in this country is collapsing. Poverty is increasing. And we have got to address those issues and come up with policies that make the ordinary person in this country know that we are on their side, that we're prepared to stand up to big money interests. And sometimes I think some folks on the left don't quite get that message. We're not going to win elections unless we do.
Well, the big economic news, of course, Bernie, the last 6 months, at least in the newspapers, and I think affecting all of us, has been the housing crisis and the financial speculation crisis that we've had. And Congress has moved quickly to pass work on financial bailouts. What is your take on how Congress has approached this crisis?
Well, they've moved fairly fast. Bush originally opposed the effort until just almost a few days ago. And let's hope that it works. As you know, Bob, and I would say, yeah, the housing crisis is huge. We got some just huge numbers of people who are losing their homes. This is just horrible. But don't underestimate what high energy prices are doing to people as well. And, in fact, on that area, we have not been making the kind of progress that we should be making, taking on the oil companies, taking on the speculators, moving to sustainable energy. And that concerns me. There was a bill just passed yesterday, that we hope will provide support to people who are now struggling to pay their mortgages, who have seen the fact that their mortgages are now worth more than their houses are, and to help neighborhoods. We've got money going into neighborhoods to help communities make sure that people can rebuy or purchase foreclosed homes to protect neighborhoods. We got an affordable housing trust fund in there, which will help build lower-income housing that I worked on for a number of years. So it's a complicated bill. It's a hugely expensive bill. And I voted for it because I think we got to get a handle on this housing crisis, or it could just further extend the crisis that we're currently in general.
Well, Senator Bernie Sanders, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to kick me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time from your very busy schedule to join us today. And good luck with everything you do in the future, Bernie.
Well, good luck to you, Bob, and keep up the great work you're doing on media reform.
Much appreciated. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for working the board today and Jason Croft for helping out. I'll be back 1 week from today. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Mostly sunshine is in today's forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area. The high around 84 degrees, southwest winds up to 10 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low around 65, light southeast winds. Partly sunny tomorrow and more possible showers and thunderstorms are on the way. the high around 88, south winds up to 10 miles an hour.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.